I always have to use them nowadays.
Steele and Tom Walsh.
Well, in a good example of how to respond well to a crisis, David Steele is not here. We actually have Tom Best here with us, and you can see how well this panel has handled crisis with grace under pressure, and how well we have filled this panel with an excellent, excellent addition. But if you really stop and think about it, this happens all the time. If you throw out examples of names like Tylenol, Toyota, BP, Vioxx, Microsoft, there's no lack of situations, or most recently, you don't even think of it this way, but obviously the tragic events in the city of Boston. These are all high-profile or crisis situations that have befallen major cities or major companies, be it through litigation or worse, and it happens all the time. And it's really for in-house counsel and I think for outside counsel, it's not really a question of if, it's more a question of when and what. Because it often can happen even when you think you did something good. If you think about it, when Facebook put Sheryl Sandberg on the board, she's one of the few female directors of a publicly traded company. Well, they thought they were doing something good. It was something good, but they got hammered in the press. Same thing when Sears extended medical benefits to same-sex partners. There's a whole host of it. I do a lot of celebrity endorsement deals for a nail polish manufacturer. We did a line with Justin Bieber. Right around that time, he started getting bullied for not being masculine enough. I mean, I'm not saying him doing a nail polish thing was maybe the best idea, but that notwithstanding, you know, even when you're doing something good, you can wind up getting hammered. And it's not always a bet the company situation either. I mean, a lot of times what you find is it is those smaller things, but they can have great impact on how a litigation will go or how the company's operations are going to go. And it's amazing. I mean, if each of us comes from a very different experience. And, you know, I shared that one story with about the nail polish manufacturer. I've also helped a major pet food company deal with a product recall situation. And you can imagine the challenges that you face, given that under insurance company rules, a pet is personal property, and the value of a dead pet is the depreciated value of the personal property. Try explaining that to someone that their loved family member is worth about $3. Talk about a PR nightmare. And I just want to very quickly go down the row and just give you examples is, again, it's not always a bet the company situation like that product recall, but these things happen all the time.
So one of the examples you use that's out in the news a lot was BP, the BP oil spill. I'm sure most of the people in this room, if you have operations in the Southeast, you have filed claims in the Southeast. That's a great example of bet the company. You know, other ones that we deal with every day is if you work in a company that has a lot of exposure to the public and to consumers, you can get allegations that you have caused issues in their home, you've caused infestations or things companies struggle with. And one news story in the Atlanta area, all of a sudden you get a phone call and it's migrated through 10 media markets and it's been picked up on the AP wire. Or you have a franchisee who has done something terribly stupid and potentially illegal, and all of a sudden the news story is that your company has perhaps done something like put surveillance software where they shouldn't. And things like that, they blow up and they start with one little small dumb incident in a rural area or in a small town, and all of a sudden you're being covered in the AP wire, you're on the ticker on CNN, and your stock price starts to feel the effects of it.
Yeah, one very challenging situation I was involved with involved a very high-profile celebrity client. And as a result of some transgressions in his personal life, there was a scandal, very public scandal. And as a result of that publicity, some of the companies he had endorsement contracts with tried to cancel the contracts. And then at the same time, he was facing people spoofing the transgressions So we had a very difficult situation on a number of fronts.
Okay, so from the Home Depot standpoint, on the big side, back in May of 2011, we had one of our stores in Joplin, Missouri, destroyed by a tornado, and it was tragic across the whole company. We had one associate passed away, and several customers that were trying to come into the store passed away, and so that was we had to deal with that on a big scale. But we also have to deal with things on a smaller scale, so. Every single time that we install something in somebody's house, if we do it wrong, there is a potential for that customer to be angry. And sometimes they may go to the local consumer affairs reporter, and trying to work through those local issues with the consumer affairs reporters also puts into account some of these same type of issues.
And that's really one of the things that's changed, I think, for many of us from the time we started practicing till now, which is the 24-hour news cycle. And it's not, you don't have time or luxury of time that you did before. The advent of bloggers and social media has completely changed the game. And it's not just something that affects big, massive companies like the Home Depot. It will, like I said, affect every single one of you out there at some point in your career. And really, part of the problem is that fear is such a powerful force, and conclusions get drawn at the outset. And it's really hard to reverse. And most people's gut reactions are actually counterproductive. You know, your gut reaction is no comment. Your gut reaction as an attorney is, well, let me find out what went wrong. Or we're also used to defending our actions, especially if we're the ones who greenlit a project. So I think what we're really hoping to do here is to try to help you guys move past that, to try to give some concrete examples of things that you can do so you're not in a situation of a no comment, you're not in a situation of trying to figure out even where do I start. You know, we're trying to really make this much more interactive than the other ones. We want this to be almost a workshop style. So we invite you guys to ask questions as we go along as opposed to waiting to the end. You know, the things that we're going to talk about today are preparing in advance. Sloan's going to take the lead on that. Quickly identifying what's happening. Tom W. is going to take the lead on that. Jumping into action. Tom B. is going to take the lead on that. And then I'll back clean up, I guess, on additional best practices to try to conclude the matter. But in order for us to help really tailor our remarks to you guys, because we want this to be as valuable as possible, by show of hands, I'd like to see which of you guys are involved in companies that are business-to-business or B2B facing as opposed to B2C. Are you dealing with end users and customers like the Home Depot, for example? Or Crystals, take that. That's a better example. They've got customers coming in. A lot of Sloan's job is the company is dealing with customers. So that's a B2C as opposed to, let's say, I'm DeWalt and I'm supplying folks to or supplying hammers to Home Depot. I would be a B2B. So by a show of hands, who here is on a B2B type of situation? Okay. What about B2C? All right. Same thing, litigation versus transactional. By a show of hands, how many of you all involved in litigation primarily? Transactional? Wow, okay. My people. All right, good. Well, the title of the panel is really called, you know, officially, you know, Court of Public Opinion. But really, truth be told, it probably should be called Guardian of the Brand, because I know that's how all four of us view our job with our clients. And especially, again, in as consumers' tastes are changing and brand identity and brand growth becomes paramount in terms of getting your product sold, a lot of what we're going to talk about today really gets back to how do you preserve, protect, and grow brand. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Sloan, who will talk to us a little bit about preparing in advance.
Thank you. Just as a question out there, and I know that Joe is going to raise his hand for this one, how many of your companies have crisis management teams already in place? Or you have clients who have crisis management teams in place. So I have had the fortune or the misfortune of working all over different industries and different companies across the United States. I practiced in Florida, Pennsylvania, Washington State, and have had to travel globally for the different jobs. And I have never worked for a company that had a crisis management team already in place. I've never worked for a company when they've experienced, you know, their first criminal regulatory investigation across 10 countries, or when they had, you know, a customer go on Good Morning America and talk about how the company had wronged them, and there's five class actions and maybe five or six independent lawsuits, and, you know, it's about the company issue with the business model at stake, or a company that, you know, has looking to turn around and really recapture what its legacy and history was. And when you come into these companies and your job, whether you're the general counsel or you're just part of the litigation team or you're the outside counsel, how do you build that crisis management team out? How do you get resources? How do you get attention? And the bad answer is what I have found is you often cannot get that attention until something bad happens. And once that first crisis happens, it's really easy to get your CEO or to get your board to focus and devote time and resources, whether it's tangible or intangible costs. But what I have done, not at Crystal, where I have only been for a very short time, under a month now, but in companies where I've had to help build out the crisis management teams, the first thing really is to sit down and identify your key business partners. And for the B2C company, sometimes that's going to be your key vendors who might be involved. Something similar that Home Depot, I'm sure, experiences is product liability actions, where perhaps they didn't manufacture it and it causes a fire is the one that I've most frequently dealt with, where it destroys a home, where it kills someone, or even worse, it kills a child in the home. If you are B2B, sometimes it's you are the key business partner in that significant company. For you, when you were doing the pet recall, I think, is reaching out to you to ask you to be part of the crisis management team and what is your role there. At my last company, when I put together our first crisis management team, I had to get buy-in from the CEO and the CFO and from the board. We pulled in our key business units, which varied depending on the type of crisis. We had a regular PR firm that handled our everyday media, and we're responsible for maintaining regular media contacts. And then we had a separate firm that handled our crisis PR. We engaged vendors to be part of that team when it dealt with product liability, and we engaged our outside law firms when it was regulatory in nature or significant litigation that involved national-level class actions.
So if I could just sort of chime in. So in terms of sort of the preparation in advance, one thing that I'm real proud of our company is that we get a little bit of practice preparing in advance with the hurricane seasons that come up. And we're a very important company when hurricanes are either coming or after they've left, in terms of getting people's houses and companies built back and the economy going again. And so we have an entire team that prepares months in advance for the hurricane season that's going forward. So it's a cross-functional team of merchants, operators, supply chain, public relations, government affairs, legal, maintenance, building services, everybody getting together to get on the same page 2, 3, 4 months in advance, so that when the storms start coming, we can open up a command center and then sort of implement the plan that we have in place. We found that by doing that, we serve the customer better and really get to one of our sort of core values, you know, taking care of customers. And we couldn't be as nimble doing that if we didn't prepare in advance. One of the great things about sort of that approach is that when a crisis that's not weather-related comes up, we have interrelationships among our different areas. We know who to go to in those areas to break down the silos and make sure that every area of the company is interest or aligned.
If I could add just a little bit about the public relations part, we're all lawyers here. Some of us think we have good public relations sense, and a lot of us do, but we're not public relations professionals. We don't have the contacts with the media. We don't speak the same language or not the exact same language. And so if you have a problem that's very high profile and critical to the company, having the right public relations firm helping out is very important. Some of them, they're not all the same. Some of them are crisis-oriented. Some of them will aggressively fight back with the press if they see misinformation going out about the company. So that to me is a key part of the team. I would say also security can be a key part of the team. Outside security firms have a lot of assets that they can be used to brought to bear in a really bad situation.
Sloan, you talked a little bit about assembling the team in advance, and David, you talked about trying to get the cross-departmental folks working together. How do you do that? So we've talked a little bit, this slide here talks about who's on the team, but then the question, you know, Sloan, talk a little bit about, so what do you do with them in advance? What sort of things do you have them do so they are ready when the storm hits or the shoe drops?
So in our... In my particular situation, we had already had a media cycle about a year before the next media cycle started. So we did have external PR engage both the regular and the crisis firm. And for us, it was because our regular PR firm, we had such a long relationship with them. They really were, they talked in the we and us, and we really wanted someone to be able to step out of that box of the relationship we need on the everyday and really be able to provide a very unbiased, even critical assessment as needed. And so for my company then, it was more beneficial to do that. But what we did is we sat around the room, we brought in our outside counsel, and we brainstormed on what do we think could happen. And we drilled our outside counsel, and I drilled my other outside counsel and attorneys I knew in the area. What are, and for us in particular, it was a prominent plaintiffs firm, what are they known to do? What's their method of attack? How do they use the press? And what we identified is they use a series of press cycles. And so about every 4 days, they would stagger out how they filed cases or how they filed motions. They maintained better relationships with the media contacts than probably any lawyer I've ever seen. And had the relationships where they could take advantage. So we prepared probably 10 versions of the same basic statement that we had ready to tailor. We had kind of a phone tree of if you got the call or if you saw the ticker, the banner, because we didn't always get tipped off before the story went to print, this is who you called, and then this person, and how do we get it to the people the quickest? And then, oh gosh, please don't forget that, you know, this is a active litigation matter. There is exposure. And so whereas no comment is absolutely the wrong answer, at the same time you have to balance, as we all know, the risk of talking about a case when you have open litigation, when discovery is still pending, when new cases are being filed. So everything that you're doing, everything you're saying in the press is going to be picked apart in a deposition, and your corporate designee or your CEO who might get subpoenaed or it's going to be the one in the hot seat. And so you want to have the PR people construct the statements. You need your outside lawyers to try to water it down as much as possible and make it say nothing. And then one of the things that I learned out of that experience was not just the outward-facing effect, but the inward-facing effect. It was not necessarily as intuitive to think about the effect on the workforce and how the employees would react, because this wasn't like a store being destroyed or someone being hurt inside a store where you would think the employees had a connection. But sometimes I think we don't think about as much how much our employees buy into our company's culture and all that time we spend on training them and incorporating our culture and making them part of the team. You know, when the company gets hurt, they take it too. They get the same comments at their cocktail parties or their holiday parties or their birthdays. And so the internal communication became as important to us as the external communication. And so whereas HR wasn't originally part of that team, we stopped and brought in our HR and our HR communications people to format internal statements, knowing that they would be discoverable and would be part of any ongoing litigation. And then we had to communicate with our vendors who we didn't want them to pull brands from our stores because we needed the brand, we needed the names, we needed to be able to market them. But just like we have morals clauses and we have the ability to get out of contracts, our vendors have clauses in their contracts that would say, if we think that you're going to hurt our sales, you know, we can pull all of our stuff out of your stores like that. And so it was a learning the how many different facets of communication, and each one has to be tweaked a little bit differently, and everybody wants more information than you can give. And so it's really a very delicate balancing act, but it doesn't reside in just one group. It can't just be external PR or HR or, you know, your purchasing group.
Now, you'll notice in the handout materials we've given you some examples of contract provisions along the lines of the prepare in advance. Talked a little bit about morals clauses. Events of default, talked a little bit about some restrictive covenants, confidentiality, indemnity backed up by insurance, preferably theirs, not yours, things like that. So those are other things. We don't want to get into them today, but they're just examples for you guys to think about that may be helpful to you as part of this whole mantra of preparing in advance.
If I could just add one thing, when you look at them, you'll see that they're not all created equal, and depending on which shoes you're in, you might choose one versus another. But it's the language really counts in those situations if you're trying to terminate a contract or you risk being terminated.
To me, the toughest part about preparing in advance is actually preparing in advance. So it's not like anybody has 2 or 3 hours to go into a conference room and do a hypothetical, right? Everybody's got a job. They're all going 150% on their day job. And but having the discipline and the rigor to actually take that time, I think you end up benefiting from doing it, but it's tough to get sort of that universal engagement sometimes when you've got different pressures to bear.
The other thing, putting aside the B2B group for a second, for the B2C people is the due diligence. You know, we engage companies to mine for customer issues that are out on the anywhere, the internet, Twitter, Facebook, any type of social media. We will go in, and not only do we have our own internal teams looking for those customer opportunities, but we also engage vendors to source for them. And the idea is by addressing all the customer issues proactively, we hope to take what is a small one-off situation, prevent them from going to the investigative reporter, but even if they do, is to have already built that relationship with that reporter. You can usually identify your key markets where they're going to go after you more often.
Which is a perfect segue to the next thing we wanted to talk about, which is how to quickly identify what is and is not happening and who it's impacting. Tom, do you want to spend
sure.
a few minutes?
Sure. You know, just I think trying to anticipate, just to follow on some comments before, trying to anticipate what the problems might be is important. And just a sort of a pitch for Primaris here, identifying local counsel that could help you in those situations is also important. So in my experience, sometimes the crises have been out of state, and it's been important to find somebody local who can help you navigate the local issues. The early detection methods, it is important to try to identify the problem quickly, give yourself a little room to formulate a plan. As Andrew was saying, it's a 24/7 news cycle. People are paid by how often hits are made on their blogs and on their news articles. There's a lot of effort by those people to get stories out right away. So there's really not as much time as you would hope. So trying to detect the problem early and looking for hints that there might be a problem coming, I think, is important. Along with the internet searches that Sloan mentioned, and I think that's a very good idea. If you're doing it on your own for a client or you're in-house, you don't have an external PR firm, there's all sorts of information in blogs, in the comments sections of news articles, that can tip you off that there's a problem. So I think it's important to really dig down and scour for issues. We found that cultivating sharing information is very important. If you can, within your organization, create a sense of trust that people can share the bad news, that it's not, you know, compartmentalized, it gives an opportunity for the right people to look into things and try to identify a problem before it gets to be a big problem. I think even low-level rumors should be checked out, followed through. It's often indicative of a bigger problem that might be coming. Internally also, looking at your, if you have an intranet for your company, monitoring what your employees are saying is also important. And then I think, customer service complaints, emails, and then what are your key contractors saying? Are they reporting problems with your product? Are things happening that are starting to show a pattern that you can try to, remedy the problem before it gets to be a big problem? When you do discover the problem, I think it's important to investigate fully what happened. Now, that sort of goes without saying. Of course, you're going to investigate it. But I think it's important to try to talk to the parties involved in the incident directly. Sometimes the information can get filtered, and sometimes intermediaries have agendas. And so talking to the parties involved is very helpful, and talking to the people surrounding the problem is also helpful. Even if the party's not, let's say you had a problem out on a plant floor somewhere, talking to some coworkers is very valuable to try to find out, what really happened, so that you can be prepared.
You want to talk a little bit about some of the different stakeholders that are involved, and how you identify who's involved and what their motivations might be?
Sure. I think Sloan mentioned, considering employees and obviously also and business partners. But some other parties to consider, customers and shareholders, and if your organization has a charitable foundation, the charitable foundation, and talking to all these stakeholders or trying to get input from the stakeholders when you're trying to formulate your plan for dealing with the crisis and protecting the brand is important, because there are different perspectives. You may not weigh them all the same. Some may be, more important than others, but I think it's valuable to hear what people have to say, obviously sort of directed towards the crisis team, so pushing the information up. I think it's also important to do some big picture thinking at this point. It's tempting to just fight the crisis of the day, but if you can give yourself a little time to think about the big picture, what does your brand really stand for? What are the really key components to your brand? What can you do without? What can't you do without? I think that's the way to be thinking about it a little bit when you're formulating your action plan. I think that when you start thinking that way, then you think about what can your brand withstand, what's going to be a success under the circumstances. You want to be careful to preserve the crown jewels, preserve the really important part. And I think that's a good way to think about the plan, and having your big picture thinkers involved, I think, is important. And that can be people outside the company, it can be people inside the company, but people who are really familiar with and knowledgeable about your brand is important.
I think one of the other things to consider too is, especially when you're looking at the different stakeholders, each of them will want something different. And it's not always just financial. Sometimes folks just want an apology. And I think that we so often are focused on deflecting legal liability and lose sight of the financial outcome that the company needs to grow. It needs to maintain relationships with suppliers, vendors, customers. Because at the end of the day, once this storm is over, that's what's needed is business as usual. And also, I think folks often minimize the emotional aspect of it, and that's where an apology can be very powerful, or other elements. And so just encourage you guys not just to think in terms of deflecting legal liability, but really think about satisfying people's emotional needs and satisfying their, as well as your company's or clients' financial needs.
One of the things that can get real interesting with sort of the stakeholders is, you know, what happens when the stakeholders disagree about the crisis. So you know, you've got a supplier who says, there's nothing wrong with my product, and you know, where a company would say, oh yeah, there is, and you know, how do you sort of work through those particular issues to, because you know, you want to support your supplier's product as best you can and sort of stay on message as best you can with your supplier and other stakeholders. But it becomes a challenge when stakeholders don't necessarily agree. And how do you sort of work through those particular issues?
We can add one more thing, and this is just a legal part, which is this is a good time also to look at your key contracts and pull them out, take a look at what are the morals clauses, what are the events of default, what are the representations that have been made, and that's going to also influence your thinking as you're developing your plan.
The other time, you want to talk a little bit about jumping into action, because we've now put our plan together thanks to Sloan. The other time's helped us identify what really is happening and who's involved. Now tell us, all right, now let's do it.
Yes, so the perfect example was the call from David that said he couldn't be here today and that I needed to step in. And so I guess the first one is sort of stay calm. And I guess the biggest visual that I can think of is, it's an old one, but with Kevin Bacon in Animal House at the end of the movie when you know, everything's freaking out. He's nothing's here. Everybody stay calm. I mean, that's kind of sort of the sense I get, which is, you know, just to the extent you can kind of breathe, you step back, look at the plan. You got to balance that a little bit with, you can only step back so far because you might have a news cycle coming up at 6 o'clock and the reporter called you at 5 o'clock. And you know, sometimes reporters, they probably do that on purpose, right? To sort of put that deadline pressure on you in hopes that maybe you're not quite as buttoned up as you need to be. And so if you got a plan in place and you can sort of anticipate a problem, you might have the statements ready sort of in the hopper that you can sort of bring back and look at. And if you don't have those, it's okay. Hopefully the company's got, you know, a set of core values that sort of serve as a guide rail to what any response can be. And if you're a company that's put those corporate values throughout the company and have gained a lot of credibility with your core values before a crisis, you really can rely upon them to help guide you to what the next step's going to be. You know, once the crisis has kind of cropped up, hopefully you've got sort of that email listserv or you've got sort of your contacts ready to go. And you know, everybody, we talked about the panel earlier today, everybody wants to be contacted. Everybody wants their emails. And it's tough. As lawyers, we want to control the information, and the business people want to disseminate it. So you got to work through that balance a little bit. But you do need to do that. One example was kind of interesting was apparently Johnson & Johnson, when they had the big Tylenol scare, within 3 days, they had kind of made their decision let's see what they do. They made their decision to sacrifice one quarter of their profits as restitution, and it completely saved their brand. They really handled that a good way, and they found 120 consecutive quarters. Captain Sully with the airplane, and he's up there trying to make a decision on take care of the plane, take care of the passengers on the plane, and he had to make a very quick decision to, you know, obviously put the passengers' safety first. And that had kind of an interesting thing because he's putting the passenger safety first, exactly the right thing. that plane's not a cheap plane, right? It's a $60, $70 million plane, and how you sort of deal with those particular issues. The other thing you need to think about is not everything's going to be perfect in whatever crisis management plan that you have. Sloan talked about that plaintiff's lawyers are very savvy from a public relations standpoint, too. So your message isn't the only message that's necessarily out there in the press. And sometimes you need to figure out how do you declare victory? Are you going to fight every single potential misstatement in somebody else's PR campaign? Or are you going to sort of go back to sort of your core message? What exactly do you want to have your message be? And maybe let some of the untruths go by. That's a delicate balance, but you can't win everything. You have to figure out and pick and choose.
And Tom, can I jump in for a second? Because we keep going back to the talking, you know, rely on your brand culture, rely on your company, rely on your good deeds. And if your company hasn't standardized its practice of how it talks about those, about how it publishes it, even just on its external facing site, you know, we all know that one bad deed or one mistake or one error that you make can seem to overshadow all the good that you've done. But as a company, and a company like Johnson & Johnson was a great example, that has really done a lot in the communities that it's in, and it's touted that, and it has marketed it, and it has put it out there, and it does press releases, and it has a normal and ordinary practice of putting out the things that it does, or even just what its employees choose to get involved in. You're creating that good, positive persona. You're taking your bullet point culture that's on your wall, and you're showing your community how you live by that. And so when that mistake happens, or when that goof up or that liability or exposure comes, and you say, no, no, wait, we're really a good company, the answer back shouldn't be, well, how would we know? You know, it should be, look at the things we've done, look at the community involvement, and you don't have to go out and do those things to look good. But as you execute on your culture, remind your management teams not to be shy about talking about it, not to be shy about making a little, link on their website where you can jump over to that charity, or, when the Oklahoma had the tornadoes, I imagine most of the companies in this room, either the companies or your clients, did donations and did funds. And did you talk about that? Did you post it on your site? And that seems a little cold-blooded. But it's something where you're showing how positive you are and how you want to be that good, upstanding community member. And so when those blips happen or when those bombs go off, you can rest a little bit on your laurels, or you at least have something to point to and say, yes, we screwed up here, yes, this went badly. But look at all the things that we've done and we're continuing to do and we will do in the future. And when you're looking at how to resolve those matters and you're looking at that emotional element, remembering those intangibles. I recently settled a case where we agreed to provide a scholarship to a high school student, $1,000 a year for 10 years. And that knocked $100,000 off the table on the settlement value for $10,000. But the goodwill of associating that high school scholarship, that intangible, that community value, was something that was hard to walk away from, and it would have looked very unreasonable for the other side to walk away from it. And so it got way more value and mileage. And then we're also able to say, look, we support these local communities. So don't forget to, if you walk it, that's great, but you've got to talk that you're walking it too, and you need to put it out there for when these things happen.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think the greatest thing that you can leverage if you do that as part of your preparation in advance, sometimes when things go wrong, your customers are your PR department, meaning that, you know, every news story has the ability to comment on it now, right? And so sometimes if you've established that community involvement, you've gained that trust with your community, all of a sudden the community is supporting you. And that can be a very powerful thing to potentially change the direction of a story. So that's another interesting thing with kind of the news of the day.
Well, and one of the points that you'd made earlier is really always remembering to focus on your business. I mean, your most important constituencies are your customers, your shareholders, your distributors, and your employees. That's not to say the other stakeholders aren't important, but their agendas are a little bit different. And you know, one of the comments you'd made to me earlier before this panel was you got to always remember your business, and you need to try to set the agenda for them and not let the other folks set their agenda on you. So I think that's an important message. I guess just sort of the final thing we wanted to talk about is, so how do you wrap this thing up? Because we all know that things in life have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And fortunately for you, that includes this speech, which will lead to the beginning of a cocktail hour. So that will be good. But we just wanted to give you a couple more things that may be helpful to you. One of the things is to try to gather your facts carefully, you know, in a manner that addresses the emotional and financial needs, but also legal. We gave you an example in your handout of a questionnaire for claimants in a product liability type of situation. We found that even just being able to respond to people who are quite upset by saying, you know what, we really care about what's going on, we're going to do the right thing, help us gather information, was dynamite. Now, it worked brilliantly from a legal standpoint because it was free discovery, right? And they'd signed it, so it was pretty hard for them to retract it later. But it also worked wonders from an emotional standpoint because it gave people something to do, something to channel themselves into. But what almost folks didn't even realize, they were channeling themselves into a process that we had created. It was a process we won. Rather than suing us, they were engaging in our own sort of internal claims process. Another thing is to try to be generous before you're asked. I mean, sort of to Sloan's point, is I think you build a lot of goodwill that way. I mean, it's one thing to pay out when you're required to pay out. It's something else to do it before you're required to do it. And I think that it means you're going to have to pay out less in terms of total financial dollars, but you get more mileage out of it. There's also a way of apologizing without admitting fault. You know, sometimes just, I know it sounds simple, and maybe because I'm from California, I don't know, we're a little touchy-feely out there. But, you know, things like, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way. Just it's not necessarily admitting that you did anything wrong, but just you're sorry that the person's going through that can be very important. One of the things that a client CEO did that I thought was just brilliant was what we call walk the land and shake the hand. Is he went out and went and did a bunch of town halls. And it was tough. He heard things he didn't really like. It was tough. He was on the hot seat big time. But it did wonders because it basically showed the distributors that he cared and he was going to stand up for it so they didn't have to. And also it did exactly what Tom just suggested. It turned angry customers into customers that said, well, wait a second. There's a whole bunch of other companies that are affected too. How come you're the only one who's physically standing here greeting me, shaking my hand, giving me a hug, saying, you know, I'm sorry for the loss of your pet or whatever it is. It was brilliant because out of it, they wound up getting more shelf space and way more customers. The company sales boomed after it, ironically enough. The other thing I think that's important is to sort of close the matter in a dramatic fashion. There, you need to write the ending to the story like any good novel or panel. There needs to be a conclusion, and the more dramatic, the better, because certainly the incident that opened it up is usually pretty dramatic. So give some thought to ways that you can do something good, or at least has the appearance of something good that's dramatic, that not only shows that this problem most likely will never occur again, but things that you've actually done to improve the community. And then what I would do is a couple months down the road, after you've written the conclusion, tell that story again to Sloan's point, is talk about the good that you have done and, you know, make the messenger the message. I mean, saying sort of, look how well we responded to this. We care about you. We're going to stand up. We're going to do the right thing. And that's how you take what's a dip and turn it into a raise. And so, you know, again, I think one of the things to consider, and I'll close it with this or open up to Q&A if you guys want, but you know, one of the things to remember is that audience really want assurances. They really don't want excuses. So don't worry about them understanding, you know, all the intricate fact patterns that may be decisive in a court of law. In the court of public opinion, when you're explaining, you're losing. So remember brand, 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 brand. If you have a strong brand, you can withstand a storm. You can do anything. With that, if you have any questions.
The need to gather the information first before you report on the information. How do you manage that balance?
Sometimes you don't always have time to gather the information first. So at my prior company, we put certain key individuals through media training, and we negotiated for flat fees and tried to make it affordable, and we put them through a range of Q&A because we know historically what sort of litigation we experienced, what sort of media cycles we generated. And when what happened to me actually was I got a call at 5:30 frantically from our outside PR firm. They couldn't find our CMO, and a reporter was calling about a story, and they were going to go live, and it dealt with predatory practices. So not good at a time when the retail industry was slumping in their sales and companies were coming out and reporting their results. And a negative news story right in that time would have been very bad and picked up very quickly by the investment community. So we provided one of our spokespeople who was trained in this area, and we called a couple of key store managers. And within about 20 or 30 minutes, I had a manager identify a customer who had had a really good experience with us and was positive, who was willing to call the reporter back and talk to the reporter. Now, I couldn't prep him. I couldn't talk to him first. All I had time to do was call and give him the phone number of the reporter. I got to do no preparation. I didn't get to confirm that my manager was right. I had to trust that my manager knew what she was talking about. And not only did he call and talk to the reporter for an hour and a half, which scared the living daylights out of me, but the story ended up not running. It killed the media cycle. He gave such positive story and such positive impact that the reporter lost interest. Now, that doesn't always happen, and sometimes even when you provide that customer, when appropriate, they still run the story, but sometimes you just have to gamble and take the chance, and if you always position yourself for the most conservative response from a litigation perspective, you may end up winning the litigation because you didn't give them anything to go on, but you've lost in the court of public opinion, and that affects your brand, and it affects your revenue stream, and it affects your investors and shareholders, and it just, lawyers are not the ones who should be making some of those last-minute calls like that. We tend to be very risk-averse because of our roles and our obligations to the company.
And I would say even just taking a quick minute, I mean, to the point that Tom made earlier, even if you don't have time to put together a whole crisis plan in advance and role play it and do all the drills and all that, at least just taking 10 minutes at worst, but at least, hopefully you have a little more than that, but even just saying to the reporter, you know what, I will call you back in 10 minutes. But just to gather your thoughts, put down some bullet points of some key themes you want to talk about that will, some key talking points that will allow you to bridge back to it in the course of the interview. Obviously, you need to be respectful to the deadline for the reporter or else they're going to write it without you. But just taking a moment, as I think Tom said earlier, just breathe, hold on a second, and remember to put forth your agenda. Just that'd be the best 10 minutes ever spent.
I think part of the issue, too, is it goes back to relationships a little bit. So if your PR, whether it's internal or external, has a good relationship with the reporters that generally follow your company, there's sort of it's sort of an alliance between them in that they're working together every single day on either positive stories about the company or a negative one, and having your PR group have a credibility with the reporter to say, hey, give me 10 minutes so I can figure it out, get back to you, or sort of have that sort of dialogue to either have the story get killed or at least have it in such a way that you can have your message out. There are, of course, always times where you have the reporter that says, we tried to reach ABC Company, and we were not able to find them, and that's like the last thing of the story, and it makes it sound like you're ducking the story, and it probably didn't actually happen. They probably called you 5 minutes before the deadline, hoping nobody was there, because it's 5:05, and they didn't call your cell phone number. You know, it kind of depends on the particular reporter, I would think.
And be aware that reporters cycle on and off companies. So if you're a company that's followed in the news, your reporters only stay with you from 1 to 3 years, which I learned the hard way. And then they cycle off because the agencies want to continually bring in new reporters, and they mix it up. So if your PR company is focused on that one reporter or that one group, it can very quickly spin out to a new group. And so your PR firm really should be doing that for all their clients, so they maintain all the relationships. So as the reporters cycle through the companies in the community, they maintain those relationships. And if they don't, and you're a company in the news a lot, find a new PR agency. It's really important. How do I say that?
So some examples of that, you know, if you say, "I'm sorry this happened," may sound a little disingenuous, but do you have any advice?
I think listening first. So where I was, you know, we had a rule: if someone started using profanity, a customer, or started screaming at staff, they were allowed to elevate the call directly to an attorney in the legal department, and the attorney had to manage the call. So what I have found works best when someone is really upset and you have to calm them down without saying something that's going to be used against you when they sue you, the first thing I typically do is just invite them to tell me how they feel and what's wrong. And I will literally, when I get them on the phone or in person, I'll say, you know, I don't have a lot of background. I'm sorry. I'm not as well informed as I should be. Can you please tell me what you're seeing, what you heard, what happened to you, or what's your perspective? And then I'm just quiet, and I listen to them. And if it's in person, you keep eye contact as a huge element of that. If you're on the phone, it's acknowledging statements where they have pauses and say, you know, well, is there anything else? And then the next step is often acknowledging how they feel versus acknowledging the cause of the problem. The cause of the problem is what we want to avoid. Acknowledging that, I hear that you feel this way. I hear that you feel like the company has let you down. And then asking them what they want, tempering that with the situation, usually can go a long way to keeping it out of litigation. And sometimes they'll come back and just say, I just wanted someone to listen to me. I just wanted someone to call me back. I just wanted someone to respond. Thank you. Sometimes they start screaming at you again, and, you know, you just kind of let it go and let them run through themselves again. But it's delicate, and it takes practice, and I think that's why media training or speaking training is essential for your senior management if you're in and out of the public spotlight.
And we did give you some examples. If you look in the handout, there was a website statement, and then if you look at actually there's a letter that was used to actually make an offer of settlement to somebody. You know, obviously those things are completely discoverable, and so those are some examples. But other than that, I completely agree with Sloan on the approach. Sometimes you also do need to take an approach of being on the offensive, though. I mean, part of apologizing sometimes is deflecting. So getting back to that Tylenol example with Johnson & Johnson, one of the things they did, aside from fixing everything and making restitution, redesigning their bottles to be tamper-proof, they also went along, you know, and apologizing for what had occurred, they also went out of their way to point out, oh, well, there was these nefarious folks who were tampering as well. There was these bad guys. So sometimes the apology can have that additional deflecting, it's really somebody else, it's really not us. But that notwithstanding, we're going to stand up and make sure this doesn't happen again.
Be careful if it's your suppliers or a business relationship that was the bad acting third party. Throwing them under the bus where it looks great as a first response, and sometimes it's what you have to do from a PR perspective, the long-term effect on the relationship there can be quite damaging.
Your example number 4 of your contract clauses mentions athlete, sponsor, vendor, and guarantor.
It probably was an athletic sponsorship agreement.
Because what one of the ways this comes up a lot of times is more similar even just to like that nail polish example than it is necessarily a tornado coming through a store. You know, for instance, when I work with OPI, this nail polish company, that's the one they do a lot of celebrity endorsement, celebrity branding deals, and not everyone was real super thrilled in the customer base or distributor chain that they did something with Nicki Minaj, for example, or the Kardashians. And so sometimes it will come up in that way, and there's different entities, there's loan out companies and things of that nature. So.
Well, on this particular example, it came through me, so I can identify what this was as a sponsor was the business that was providing money in exchange for having their brand put on something. The athlete was the Justin Bieber of the story, who had his likeness incorporated into a company. Often, some of the companies I've worked for, some of the athletes that they have dealt with have been semi-professional and were minors. So they had already affiliated with a primary sponsor. If you're very involved in athletic sponsorships, or if you've ever watched NASCAR, you see that there's about 20 badges on those cars. And so you'll have one primary large sponsor, and they really own the relationship with that particular athlete. And the athletes often have incorporated companies that are managing their IP, their likeness, the value. And so you have a relation, you're entering into a contract with the primary sponsor if you're not the primary sponsor. You're entering into a contract with, we called it the vendor in this, which is the company that owns the likeness, the image, and then the athlete. So when you're drafting that contract, your concern is what if the athlete does something improper, illegal, or harmful to your brand, even if it's not illegal or improper. But you also have to deal with the issues of the vendor, and then as a separate agreement, usually there will be how you divvy up with the primary sponsor.
You know, I could add probably a little bit more on that. Sometimes, the guarantor might be the athlete individually. Sometimes they'll have a personal company that they run their business through, maybe it controls the IP, and then the guarantor might be the individual themselves, just to certain matters.
In this particular one, it was a parent.
Well, I guess with that, thank you.